I'm George Liston, CA. For those who love fine novels and believe that their purpose is to use the art of fiction to present complex truths, publication of The Known World was especially welcome. The subject of this novel is an aspect of slavery that is rarely examined, the fact that there were freed blacks who themselves became slaveholders. That they did so is strange but compelling proof of the moral ambiguities that come from living in a known world built upon the cruel logic of a peculiar and evil institution. In its effect, the book is a haunting passage to a time now past and an evocation of a complex human nature that is ours forever. My guest is Edward P. Jones, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Known World. Edward Jones, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for being with us. And to begin at the beginning, for people who love books, as we here certainly do, first question to a writer is always, why do you write? And I have had the pleasure of reading not just this fine book, but other things you've written. And in a piece called We Tell Stories, I got the impression you don't have any choice but to write.
No, I think that's true. I think they're generally, writers fall into two categories, those who do it because one day they want to be another John Grisham and be wealthy and famous and all of that. And there are people who do it because they are compelled to.
Mm-hmm.
They have no choice. And no matter where they are, they find themselves writing, whether physically on a page or in their heads, as has often happened with me over the years.
I want to talk about that. That's the most, to my mind, one of the most fascinating parts about how you do write, and that so much is done in your head. Mm. Can I take it from you, Mr. Jones, from what you've just said, it's a vocation. It's something that one is born to. There's no escaping it.
Yeah, I think it's rather like, something like a songbird. You know,
right.
Songbird sings, and unless you, do something to it, it's going to sing on no matter what. And I think that's the case with me.
Right.
I did all the work on the book, and my hope was that somewhere at the end of the line someone would purchase it, but I didn't know that. That wasn't a guarantee. All I knew is I wanted to write it, I had to write it, and that's what happened.
It's interesting to me also in the same context that when you've received the awards, and there are a number of extraordinarily prestigious awards you've received for the book, I thought, from what I've learned, your reaction was always, well, I've got to get up and write tomorrow, too.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean a thing about tomorrow.
No, I mean, you could, no matter what they give you, no matter what they say about you, it doesn't help with the next chapter, the next story. You know, you can't prop up all those things on top of the computer and say things right.
Yeah.
You have to do it yourself. You have to start back at the bottom of the mountain again.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing ever helps you to do that but whatever you have inside you.
Mm-hmm. And in doing this, you exercise not just a powerful, but an extraordinarily powerful degree of imagination that helps all of us visit a world that we otherwise would not have known so well. And I guess that's in my next question to you. This imagination, this use of imagination, must begin with the kernel of an idea that in some sense germinates and grows in the sense of the known world, this particular book. Where did it begin with you?
I think it's hard now, and people ask me that kind of question, and I wish now if I had known that it would be received the way it has been received, I would have taken notes every day. I would have kept a diary, because this might be of interest to people down the line.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. Probably the very first image I had may have been of Henry Townsend, a black man on his deathbed. And when he dies, he leaves about 33 slaves and a substantial portion of land to his widow. And that may have been the first image of Henry dying, and he's in a room with two or three women. And then I had to create a world around that room and that house and the piece of land that he was on.
Right.
And I think that's where it sort of started.
When that began with you, the intellectual fact that this is built upon, that in slavery there were blacks who achieved their own freedom and then brought others, was that known to you as a starting point?
I learned that there were black slave owners. I was quite surprised to learn that, as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in college, it wasn't a book. I think it was just some line someplace, a footnote perhaps, something in passing that a professor said.
Right.
And I just, of course, took it and sort of tucked it away in my head and didn't think about it again for any real reason for a long, long time until I had finished the first book I wrote mm-hmm. and was sort of thinking about what I should do next.
Yeah. And when Henry Townsend, the protagonist of the book, appears to you dying in that room, that image, that vision, how does that grows over a decade, doesn't it? I mean, do you begin, I'm so fascinated by how so much of this was, to use the phrase, written in your head
yeah.
for a long time before you even sat down to put it on paper.
I think I started thinking about this in 91, 92. Mm-hmm. That's when, you know, so much began to come into me, starting with Henry's dying. And my intention was to, because, you know, it was the 19th century, it was slavery, and I didn't know, you know, a great deal about it. So I had some 40 or so books that I had intended to read. Mm. I was going to read all of those books in, you know, a year, 2 years, 3 years, and then sit down and start writing. I kept, for some reason, putting off all the reading. I remember one book in particular, I think it was one that was done during the Depression, WPA. Negro in Virginia, I think it was. Mm-hmm. I think I read a chapter or two, and I just, there was something in me that rebelled against doing all that research. Mm-hmm. And so I kept putting it off year after year after year. In the meantime, of course, the creative part of the brain continues to do what it has to do. And so the novel kept building and building in my head, even as I put off all the research. Now, in addition to reading all the books, I had intended to visit a friend of mine in Lynchburg, Virginia, mm-hmm. and use his county as a setting. Well, I never got around to visiting Kim Woodford in Lynchburg. But again, you know, the years went on and I continued to create this book in my head. I remember there was a time where there comes a need to see the words on the screen right. or on the page. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened is that when I did finally sit down to write the entire book after about 10 years in 2001, I had 12 pages total. I had 6 pages of the first chapter, 6 pages of the final chapter. Mm-hmm. And I think that came about because I probably got up one day and said, well, you know, treat yourself to see what this stuff looks like. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened. But that I didn't want to go any further than that because I was still thinking I had to do the research. I was still thinking I had to visit my friend right. and get the lay of the land. And in 2001, a few days after Christmas, I had 5 weeks of vacation with the day job I had at that time, mm-hmm. day job I'd had for 19 years. And so I said, well, we'll start reading in earnest. And again, you know, this thing in me just rebelled against reading all those books.
Right.
So the book was in my head, and I just sat down and started writing. Mm-hmm. And as far as not having the county, not visiting my friend, I decided, well, you know a bit about this and a bit about that, so you just make up your own county. And in the end, it would work well, because had I used his county, I would mm-hmm. have been confined. I would yeah. have had to limit myself to the history of that place.
Right.
I couldn't have gone outside of that, you know. If I had written a wrong sentence, someone would have called me on it. But you create your own world, and you can say whatever it is you want to say about it.
And that's what you did. It is yeah. a world, that county. Mm-hmm. And it's been compared to what Faulkner has done and others have done. It's in no way a lesser achievement than any of that. And it also, as you've just mentioned, obviously goes right to the nature of slavery. And I want to read a sentence to you about that you've said about slavery and see how it's reflected in the book and your thought. It's a question that might have haunted you, it probably did as you wrote this, and it goes this way. What is it like for a people to become invisible in a country that the world sees as offering hope and promises to so many others? Mm. And for those who are really concerned about the place of slavery in our history, that seems to me like a very powerful evocation of what its cost was.
Yeah. It's always this great irony with this country, given, you know, the principles upon which it was founded mm-hmm. and the way, you know, so over the centuries, so many people have not lived up to those principles. Mm-hmm. Then they speak out of one side of their mouth and then turn around and do something entirely contrary to what they just said. That was one of my interests. But I know I was also interested in just how people managed to survive such an horrendous mm-hmm. situation. And I didn't even realize that was in my head until after the woman who became my editor had read it and sent it back to me and had very, very few suggestions about things. Mm-hmm. And I decided to take as fresh an eye as I possibly could and look at it again and delve into some things.
You know, I got to tell you personally, that's like your editor, that's exactly what I felt. But I call it the atmospheric quality of it, if you will. That's a perhaps too fancy phrase for the sense indeed of what it was like to live in that experience. Some people have called this almost biblical in its kind of eloquence, and this is the word I want to use now, understatement. There's a degree of, here again, I've heard this, but I also believe it myself, quietness about your language and narrative. Is that a conscious choice?
Yeah, there is, because the Bible is, I had a chance in graduate school to read the Bible, and I was fascinated by the stories that I encountered, also by the quiet language at times. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember this one particular passage, I think it was about Jeremiah, describing how they took him and threw him down the well, you know. But also, I knew that the situation of slavery brings with its own emotion, you know. And I didn't need to add any more than that, than to say the story, tell the story. In a sort of newspaper sort of fashion. Mm-hmm. These are the facts. This is what happened. And I didn't feel any need to layer any more emotion on top of any of that.
Let me take just a brief moment from our conversation to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest is Edward P. Jones, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Known World. Everyone who has written, and the reaction has been extraordinary to this book, has talked about the moral ambiguities and complexities of the known world as you have depicted them. But one thing that I have not seen, at least not very often, that I wanted to ask you about and will do now, is that, maybe this is the question, is that just confined to antebellum Virginia, or are the statements in this book, the message of this book, if you will, have resonance for our own time? I mean, our own known world, the same stratifications of race, caste, color, the same perversions of behavior against the constructs of what we call, or what we should call, our known world.
I think so, and I think part of the problem is that America has innumerable good points about it. I mean, you know, I'm sitting here. Probably had I been born someplace else in another country, I'm not sure that I would be sitting here talking to you. But at the same time, this isn't a country that likes to stand still and question things too much, you know. And I think that's why we came out of the Civil War. We were happy that we had survived it. But we didn't sit down and ask ourselves, how did we get into the situation and how can we improve things so that in 50 years and 100 years, we don't have the problems that we had, you know, that brought us into slavery. They're not with us in 100 years. Mm-hmm. And I think the country has always been on the move, you know, and it's been always too busy to sit down and think things out.
I fully agree. I mean, I think that's very well said. I've said at several points, and certainly, again, many others have said as well, that this book is extraordinary for its atmosphere, for that sense of time and place, also for its characterizations. And we could almost pick almost any of them, Elias and Moses, who you mentioned, and Moses particularly I want to talk about in a moment. But I'd love it if you would read us a selection right now that might bring two of these people to our specific attention. That is William Robbins, the slave master, and Henry Townsend, the man at the center of this.
Yes, William Robbins once upon a time owned Henry's father and his mother. And Henry's father, Augustus, bought himself out of freedom, and then he bought the freedom of his wife, and eventually they together bought Henry's freedom. Henry has become sort of a protege of William Robbins because he had spent so many years without his parents and under the guidance of William Robbins. So in a sense, William Robbins has become his father in a way. This is years and years after Henry has... His father and mother have bought his freedom, and he's become sort of well-to-do. He's done very well for himself in making boots and shoes. Mm-hmm. And now he is building himself a house, and to help in the building of that house, he has bought a slave from William Robbins, Moses. And this being Henry's first slave, he doesn't really know how to act. And I think we should just say it that way. Mm-hmm. And so one day after he and Moses have been working on the house, they've stopped and they start wrestling. And William Robbins rides up and finds them. And he calls Henry aside. "Henry," Robbins said, looking not at him but out to the other side of the road, "the law will protect you as a master to your slave, and it will not flinch when it protects you. That protection lasts from here and Robbins pointed to an imaginary place on the road all the way to the death of their property, and Robbins pointed to a place a few feet from the first place. But the law expects you to know what is master and what is slave, and it does not matter if you are not much more darker than your slave. The law is blind to that. You are the master, and that is all the law wants to know. The law will come to you and stand behind you, but if you roll around and be a playmate to your property, and your property turns round and bites you, the law will come to you still, but it will not come with a full heart and all the deliberate speed that you will need. You will have failed in your part of the bargain. You will have pointed to the line that separates you from your property and told your property that the line does not matter. You are rolling around now, today, with property you have a slip of paper on. How will you act when you have 10 slips of paper, 50 slips of paper? How will you act, Henry, when you have 100 slips of paper? Will you still be rolling in the dirt with them?
Edward Jones, that's why we read novels. That's why we read novels. I mean, that's what the institution of slavery is going to demand of Henry, despite Henry's illusion. Henry had, I think at one point even says he's going to be a better master, a good master, and that's not going to be.
Yeah, I mean, it's rather like saying, well, the old devil is dead. I'm the new devil. I'm going to be the best devil in hell that I possibly can. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's an impossibility.
Mm-hmm. Moses. Moses is the slave who is wrestling with Henry in that passage. And quite frankly, he's an extremely powerful figure in this book. I want you to talk just a bit about him, because I saw almost the whole arc of slavery embodied in his life. Well, first meet him in that, was it the sheriff's office, I think,
with
Betsy,
yes,
a woman. Well, he's going to be separated from her, but he's talking about his love for her.
Yes, exactly. Sorry. No.
You got me excited.
You're right, because I think people fail to remember that first time when we meet him. Mm-hmm. The book isn't told in chronological order. So the first time we meet Moses is at a very later stage of his life, when he's gone through a number of things. But when we meet the first time, the young Moses, he's a very, very different man. He's talking about love for this woman, and he doesn't want to be separated from this woman. But circumstances are such that that's what happens.
That's what happens. Yeah. And then at the end, he makes decisions that are, well, in the context of what he felt he had to do, he did it.
Yeah.
And yet you feel this is a soul that's been brutalized.
He is. Mm-hmm. I mean, he is. I think in that first time when we see him, and it's ironic, of course, that when we do see him, it's in the sheriff's office.
Right.
The sheriff is the greatest symbol of the law in that county. And all Moses wants is not to be separated from this woman he's been with for several months. He didn't know her before they were brought down from Alexandria, Virginia, to be sold in Manchester County. Mm-hmm. And he's come to care for her, and she's come to care for him. And it's a very different man who, at the end, what we find out, and again, this is why he's doomed, is that one of the things that I realized I was interested in is what allowed people to survive slavery. And I think family was one of them.
Yeah.
And that's why Elias and his wife Celeste are able to survive, because they have each other, they have family. What Moses does in the end, unfortunately, is because he has been brutalized to such a degree, is that what he ends up doing is essentially throwing away his family.
That's right.
You know, and that's the doom for him.
Sacrificing them to his ambition, in a way.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. He doesn't realize what's at the other end for them. Mm-hmm. He doesn't really care. Mm-hmm. All he wants is to take the place of his dead master, of Henry Townsend's place.
When you mention family, I'm moved to think of your own family, your mother in particular, and the influence and support they gave you. It seems to be absolutely primal and pivotal to all that you've done.
Yeah, I think I grew up seeing how hard she worked. I mean, you know, and I didn't want to place any more burdens on her than I needed to. I mean, I can remember at about 10, 11, we lived at just across North Capitol on K, and I went over to 7th Street to a movie. And I didn't have a watch, and I couldn't really tell what time it was. But I could tell it was getting to be about 6 o'clock, which I could have arrived at 7:30, and it would have been fine. But because I had this sense of what was right and what was wrong, the movie was called The Innocents with Deborah Carr. And it was, I never saw the end of the movie, you know, because I was so, I needed to get home. Uh-huh. I needed to be the responsible person. Uh-huh. And it was decades before I ever saw the end of the movie. I was wondering what happened to this woman who was a nanny and those two kids she was in charge of, uh-huh. and the ghosts and everything else in the movie. It was a long time because they didn't have VCRs at that time.
That's right. That's right. She is clearly a marvelous woman, I guess, whose memory is still... Always will be with you.
Yeah.
And inspiring. Yeah. And yet an aunt and others also who encouraged you.
Yeah, it was primarily my mother because we would visit my aunts in the summer. Mm-hmm.
Where would that be?
I visited the first time I remember we were away for the entire summer was South Boston, Virginia. Uh-huh. And I was 13. And that was a pivotal summer because it was the very first summer I ever read a book that didn't have any pictures in it.
After
read, comic I, yeah, I was read, yeah, I was a comic book person, uh-huh. and down in South Boston, I didn't have any of those around. And one day, my cousin had a book, and it was a British mystery, Who Killed Stella Pomeroy, uh-huh. and that was the first time I felt that you could create your own pictures,
right?
You know, and it was because I didn't have any thoughts about becoming a writer, but I think it told me something without my even realizing it.
Absolutely.
That the words themselves could do a lot.
Indeed they can. Mm. And those words which come, you know, from you, your experience, and as we've learned in talking to you so powerfully from your imagination, that's certainly one thing I'll never forget.
Yeah.
You know, also you have the, I'm sure the influence of the institutions you went to, Holy Cross College and the University of Virginia, where... either there or was it at Princeton that you have taught?
I've taught, writing? University of Virginia, mm-hmm. George Mason University, Princeton, American, University of Maryland.
Which leads to the question, how do you teach it? I mean, when again, going back to the powerful use of your imagination, creativity, how do you convey that, even in a sentence, to...
You can't. The only thing you can do is have someone write and then sit down with them and say, well, and come to what they've written with all that you've... have learned in your life, mm-hmm. you know. There's no way that you can sit down and teach it. You can only give some sort of guidance and say, well, you know, on this page, the plot seems to go a little flat. This dialogue needs to be sharpened up. The whole climactic moment here isn't quite believable. Here's what I suggest.
Mm-hmm.
And I do. I tend to suggest it a lot.
But the voice and the thought have to be theirs.
Yes. If they don't, you know... I never assign any texts when I teach, because I feel, you know, people want to be writers, they should already be reading anyway,
mm-hmm.
and they shouldn't have to come to a class for me to tell them that.
Right. That makes sense to me. I can't help also mentioning the fact that you're a Washingtonian.
Yeah, I moved back to Washington in April after living for 21 years in Arlington, Virginia.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of the novel, also fascinates me, because our novel, and without, I'm not giving anything away to those of you who have to read it, but things will end in Washington here.
Yes,
we'll see that. And this city is, I think, is you might agree with me, is itself a kind of a fascinating place in terms of antebellum and Civil War history, the institution of slavery and everything else. You know, slave pens literally existed at the foot of Capitol.
Yes, they did. Yeah, yeah.
And absolutely. You've written about this city in your earlier collection.
Yeah, it was a collection of stories that I wrote called Lost in a City, and I'm working on another collection of stories, revisiting some of the same themes and people that were in the first book.
Do you find anything symbolic about this particular city? It's the nation's capital, of course, but in the fact that slavery, all of its contradictions, its hypocrisies, cruelties existed here as well. And not so much, well, not only in terms of when they did exist here, but in terms of what remnants, resonances, or echoes might still be flowing in this very stratified city of ours.
There are, but I can't say that I've really investigated to any great degree. What happens when you're born in Washington is that it's like being born in Omaha. It's like being born in Austin or something. Mm-hmm. It's home,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you know that there is something called the government that is there.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't always have very much to do with your life, unless mm-hmm. your parents, of course, are working in the government. For the most part, when I was growing up, my mother worked in a French restaurant about a block from the White House.
Mm.
I went to school. I went to movies. I went to the corner grocery store. They were all in my neighborhood. I didn't have any need to go. The only time we went down beyond our neighborhood was when relatives came from out of town.
And wanted to see things.
I remember in particular, we lived on 10th Street. And the first thing we would do is just walk all the way down 10th Street. Mm-hmm. And the first thing we would hit the Forest Theater. And then go across the street to the house where Lincoln died.
Right.
But those weren't an everyday thing for us. I mean, I think I only went once, for example, to the monument for the fireworks.
Our patterns of life are quite similar.
Yeah.
I'm tempted. I'm not just tempted. I'm going to ask. You know, I know writers often hate to talk about what they're up to at the moment because it's obviously a very, very personally held thing. But that first collection of short stories was about Washington, won a great deal of prize-winning recognition. Is that the subject now, what you're doing now?
It is. It is. The first book came about, I think, because one of the things that struck me when I went away to college is how very little people know about Washington.
Yeah,
they don't think
that.
Of it in terms of neighborhoods. And I have been very impressed with James Joyce's Dubliners.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to do something similar with people that I knew in Washington. Mm-hmm. And now what I've done with this new work is taking some of the minor and major characters from stories in Lost in a City and build stories around them.
I eagerly await it. I also am fond of Dubliners and the dead in particular.
Oh, yes, yes.
I read that at least once a year.
Yes,
Edward Jones, talking to you has been every bit the pleasure I thought it would be. It's a wonderful personal compliment to your book, and I'm sure that I'm obviously not alone in esteeming this book, and many others are bound to read it. And as we conclude, I think it's almost an inevitable question for those of us who love novels really probably know why, but I'd love to ask a novelist why the novel is important.
I think we're born, and what a novel does, whether you're reading about some coal miner in France in the 19th century, or the wife of some doctor in one of Chekhov's stories, is that it tells us that I'm not alone in some sort of, you know, in some way. You know, I mean, it's, you can be in some locked away in a dungeon in a jail cell, and you can read about these people and realize that you are small, but in another way, you're also big because there are other people who are suffering the same thing that you're suffering, or they're being happy about the things that you're happy about. I think the thing about a novel, and short stories as well, because I write short stories, is that it sends a line out to the rest of the world, and people catch that line, and you hold that line, you're connected to everyone else.
That's wonderful. I mean, that really is. Edward Jones, thank you very, very much. I thoroughly enjoyed this.
Thank you for inviting me.
It was my pleasure.
Thank you.
Really.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Edward P. Jones, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Known World. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Our technical director is John Tyler. Our production engineer is Anthony Barber. And our assistant producer is Sharana Ward. Dialogue is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.